I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views. In 2016, the controversial psychologist Dr. Jordan Peterson became an overnight internet sensation after railing against the perceived problem of political correctness in his native Canada. Since his rise to internet stardom, much criticism has been made of Peterson's fusion of self-help and Jungian psychology with a thinly, or perhaps not so thinly, veiled conservative political agenda. But what of the criticism of Peterson from an academic and psychology-based perspective? Rising YouTube star Cass Eris is seeking to fill that void as a cognitive psychologist, taking the deep dive into Peterson's 12 Rules for Life, an antidote to chaos, in a series of videos that dissect the popular 2018 self-help book, chapter by chapter. On this edition of the show, Eris joins us to discuss not only the series, but also her background, criticisms of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, and Carl Jung, Peterson's lack of citations, the just world hypothesis, and, of course, lobsters. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to my conversation with Cass Eris, the YouTube star taking on Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life, an antidote to chaos, from the perspective of a cognitive psychologist. Welcome to Parallax Views, Cass Eris, cognitive psychologist and a fledgling YouTuber. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good. Also, I should mention, open atheist and mental health advocate.
Yep.
So, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar with your YouTube channel, Cass, when did it sort of start? I believe it was in April 2019 that you started it, so it's still a bit new, but I think it's very useful, and I'd like to get like an idea of how it came to be.
Well, it came to be out of, I don't want to say desperation, but just what am I going to do now? So we moved, my husband and I moved to California the beginning of the year for work for him, because he's got an amazing job that he loves. And we moved to Silicon Valley, and it's like, hey, cool. I have a cognitive psychology degree. I've done human factors research before. I should have no problem finding a job here. And that has not been the case at all.
I think a lot of people are in that sort of scenario themselves right now, regardless of the field that they studied in.
Yeah. It's like, it's so crazy because when I went to grad school, like I started in the mid-aughts, and I was told that like with basically any psychology PhD can get a job in statistics because we do so much of that and people like that skill. But it turns out, at least now, and especially here, that the statisticians that they're hiring are computer scientists, basically, in some way, or like physics, where they do a ton of programming. Basically, you need to be able to do either machine learning or, and I'm blanking on the program name, SQL. Like, you need to know the inside, outside, upside, downside of SQL before they'll even think about hiring you. So we don't really get that training in psychology. And then looking at user interface jobs, and I don't quite have the right skill set there either. So, yeah, just hasn't been working out. Oops, I have a habit of punching the microphone, so there's going to be bonks. So prior to this current version of my YouTube channel a couple of years ago, I tried doing one before the adpocalypse has happened. So the original format, there's a couple videos from that time on my channel now. And it was just going to be like bite-sized psychology, where it's just one topic that's part of a huger lecture. So if you like miss something during your lecture, you could look it up and hopefully have it explained to you in a different way that would make sense. And with the adpocalypses, it became quickly apparent that I wouldn't really have a sustainable channel, at least for people to pay for. So it's like, okay, it's not going to work. I'll just work on building my skill set so that when we move, I can find a job, and that didn't work out. So, yeah, did a hard think, figured out a way to make the channel sustainable and interesting, and definitely went away from the bite-sized model of explaining things. So that's where we are.
So I guess the channel has become known recently for its deep dive into Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life, but you also cover a number of different topics related to psychology. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your background in psych. You're a cognitive psychologist. For my listeners that may be unfamiliar with that term, maybe you could explain it a little bit for us.
Yeah. So psychology in general is supposed to be, and I just added this in a video that I'm editing, so it's the scientific study of mental processes and behavior. And so we're looking at behaviors which are overt and can be seen by another person or experimenter, in the case may be, and mental processes or stuff going on inside the person's head. And cognitive psychology, that's our bread and butter. So we look at things like cognitive processes. So that includes attention, memory, learning, decision making, language, a little bit of perception, and yeah, so how people think. And within that, my specialties were looking at attention and learning. And when I say learning, I don't mean like sitting in a classroom and learning. I focused on implicit learning, which is when you learn stuff that you don't necessarily realize you're learning or you're trying to learn. So the easiest example for implicit learning is riding a bicycle. That's learned through motor learning, and it ends up being something that you can do pretty well once you've learned how, but teaching someone else how to do it, like the code, it's sort of programmed in your head, and being able to say that code, there's a mismatch.
Similar to like, I've known a few people that are like pretty good with drumming, you know, in like mm-hmm. a rock band. And when they try to like teach other people, there can be a bit of a learning curve because a lot of the more experienced drummers, it's muscle memory. So mm-hmm. teaching Absolutely. It is kind of difficult at times.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, like with drumming or playing a different instrument, the early learning is sort of getting the technique and the basics down. And then once you've got that down, then you can start doing the other things where you're building on top of that, different styles or different like drumming patterns. And yeah, so the foundation would be implicit, and also something that tends to come with implicit knowledge is it tends to be an automatic process where you don't really have to think about it. It requires less attention to do. And so you can engage in other things, whereas if somebody's a novice, they haven't gotten it to that well-rehearsed stage yet. And so it's a lot harder for them to sing while they're playing or really concentrate on anything other than what they're doing. So, yeah.
And how did you become interested in studying psychology? I'm just curious.
So in high school, I thought I was going to be an astrophysicist, and I started dating my husband in high school and got him into physics, because at the time he thought he was going to go into the army and be an engineer, and that was going to be his thing. This was pre 9/11, so I managed to talk him out of that, and he didn't go into the army, thankfully, because he would have been deployed and it would have been a nightmare. So we started off both taking the physics courses, and something I learned taking AP in high school and then afterwards is it doesn't come naturally to me. Like, I can put the numbers in the formulas, but I have no idea why. And my husband, it was just second nature to him, all of it. And it was frustrating doing homework with him because it's like, I don't understand what's going on. And he wasn't at a point yet where he could really explain it. So there were many tears on many homework nights. But in high school, I would threaten to go into psychology because it didn't make sense. And then I actually eventually took a psychology course in undergrad from my favorite professor and like, this is what I want to do. And then, so the school we went to, we only had experimental psychologists of various types. We had zero counseling classes. So I have never taken a counseling class in my life, which is odd for a psychologist. And eventually, like, I was interested in perception. I was interested in cognition, applying to grad school, like, I like this and I like this. So I sort of just like flip through and like, okay, so implicit learning and human visual processing, and just looked up what programs there were and started applying and got in a cognitive program.
What was it that, like, you sounded like really enthusiastic remembering, you know, taking those first classes. Was there something that like really just stuck out to you that made you realize like, oh, I really like this?
So I think the thing is, and I think maybe this is part of the stick up my butt about Freud, is Freud, Jung, and other psychologists like that, Dr. Phil even, like, you hear psychology and that's the one type of psychology people tend to think of. And in high school, like, I think we had the Learning Channel, Discovery Channel and stuff before they went completely off the reality deep end. And I'd remember seeing documentaries on like different brain stuff or other things like that. And just, it was always really interesting to me, but you know, I didn't think about what sort of researcher would be doing that. And so finding out like, oh, it's psychology that's doing the really cool brain research or attention research. And I get it now. yes, this is what I want to do. I'm good at this. Yeah, so it was kind of always there's an interest, but then like figuring out that that was, it's psychology that's doing this cool research, sort of what tipped me over the edge, especially the amazing professors I had.
And now I guess with the YouTube channel, you can sort of educate people mm-hmm. about these different topics, because there's so much that I think people would have questions about, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
You get a lot of requests, I assume, right?
Yeah. And I'm finding, like, I'm going to kind of go off sort of what I've been talking about, because, like, the mental health stuff is important to me, like, personally, even though I don't have training in it, so I talk about it. And then the Peterson book is something I'm sure we'll talk a lot about later, but it's, like, not specifically in my area of expertise. And so I was getting a lot of requests, like, oh, can you talk about borderline personality disorder? Can you talk about, like, this counseling thing? And it's like, okay, I've said I'm not a counseling psychologist. I'm a cognitive psychologist, but most of my videos have not been about that. So I'm going to I think I might start with, like, animal perception, because that's kind of cool. A couple experiments there to kind of try to get people closer to what my actual research areas are, so it's less weird and conflicting, where it's like, I'm a cognitive psychologist, but I'm not talking about cognitive half the time. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think sometimes even people will confuse the different fields. Like, you know, I think there's people that will confuse a therapist and a psychiatrist, and like, what's the difference between all these different fields within this bigger picture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, I giggled because it's the video that's going up tomorrow. Is I finally talk about psychiatry and kind of put it in comparison to like counseling psychologists or other psychologists, like where it all fits together. So, yeah.
You also mentioned, you know, mental health is a very near and dear to your heart type of topic. Is it okay if I ask you why that is? Like,
yeah.
I know you talk about it in your videos a little bit, but for my listeners that maybe haven't seen the videos yet.
Yeah. So I have bipolar, generalized anxiety disorder, OCD, and then some other things probably. And then my dad was diagnosed with depression, Tourette syndrome, and then some anxiety stuff like OCD and other anxiety things. Tourette's and the other anxiety things tend to go hand in hand, and I'm a carrier for Tourette's, so I have some partial expression of some of the anxiety stuff. But I think with the channel, I wanted to talk about some mental health stuff from a different perspective than I'd really seen on YouTube so far, where it seems like there's people who have the different disorders and who talk about their experiences with it, but it's on a very just personal, anecdotal story level. And then there's like social workers or counseling psych or people who have sort of some training in it and are counselors at some level who talk about the different disorders, but from a more removed perspective. And so I'm in this interesting little space where I've got the ability to read the papers and disseminate the findings of them while also going through it myself and being open about my experiences with it. Because I know some people I went to grad school with have different psych disorders, but it's not something they necessarily want to make known. Partially because of the stigma associated with it and maybe having it get in the way of their career.
I was going to ask about the stigmatization of mental illness. I think a lot of people would say, oh, it's gotten better since, you know, the days of, you know, a book like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was trying to sort of shed a light on that issue of stigmatization and abuse in hospitals. And people would say, oh, well, it's not like that anymore. But, I mean, I think there still is a lot of stigmatization that goes on.
I think we're getting better about talking about mental health and psych disorders and things, but yeah, there is still a fair amount of just sort of pop culture knowledge about different disorders, like with Tourette syndrome, where it was, I'm trying to think if there was ever a character who had it when I was a kid, and I don't think there was ever like a movie or book, or maybe a book, but certainly not in the general media. Like, there wasn't a character with it, I think, until As Good As It Gets, maybe. And my dad loved that movie because it's like, he loved Jack Nicholson, and like, oh my God, there's a character with Tourette's and OCD, and this is incredible. And, you know, it wasn't exactly the best character, and it was a dramatic representation of those disorders, but it was something for my dad. And so I think, like, more people are sort of aware of, like, Tourette syndrome, but it is still kind of a caricature of the experience for a lot of people. Like, I know the South Park episode, even though that was, like, probably a decade ago, at least, on Tourette syndrome, where, you know, Cartman thought he could just swear as much as he wanted and have it play off as the disorder versus somebody who actually had the disorder. But even that was like a more extreme form of Tourette's with the swearing, where most people who have Tourette's don't have that as their vocal tic. So I think, like, general knowledge has kind of improved on a lot of things, but it's still kind of hit or miss. Like, the Jennifer Lawrence movie, I think Silver Linings Playbook? Handbook?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Silver Linings Playbook. Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah, I mean, like, yay, bipolar character who is not what I experience at all and is kind of making me uncomfortable.
I grew up on that one, what was it, the Winona Ryder,
Girl Interrupted?
Yeah, that one was the one I grew up on. But I think even a movie like that had very, it's still one-dimensional in so many ways.
Yeah. Well, I think, I'm trying to remember, because I think the main character had borderline personality disorder in that, and then Jolie's character was sort of non-specified, but maybe antisocial personality disorder, with, like, very manipulative and charming and willing to do what it takes to get what she wants. And, yeah, I mean, the characters weren't as nuanced as they were in the original book. I'm sure I haven't read it. But, yeah, I mean, it got across a lot of points, even if it was kind of a superficial level.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think there's truth to the idea that, you know, things are going in the right direction. But I wanted to stick on this just for a second, because I always find it fascinating, some of the stereotypes people throw out about different disorders or mental health issues, you know, because, like, I'll hear people say something like, oh, yeah, people with Asperger's, they're all like little Einsteins, or, you know, or people with borderline are all, you know, like violent and blah, 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 or schizophrenics are, you know, like violent street people. And I'm like, all of these are just sort of really one-dimensional myths. I mean, these aren't, you know, with schizophrenic people, I mean, they're more likely to be victims of crime than the ones, you know, committing violence against others. And yet it surprises me, because I always find that a lot of people don't realize that. They still sort of buy into the stereotypes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think part of it is the dramatic examples stand out. And certainly, like, if a crime happens and the person had some sort of disorder, like, it is immediately part of the title of whatever pieces come out about it. So, yeah, there is sort of, I'm forgetting the bias, but, yeah, people cling to those sort of dramatic examples, like, oh, everybody with a disorder must be like this, and then people who actually have the disorder kind of keep their heads down and like, oh yeah, crazy, huh? Because there is that stigma.
Well, it's interesting. Before we dive into 12 Rules for Life, the last thing I wanted to ask you about was your atheism, because I think that mm-hmm. puts you, it's one of the things that puts you in stark contrast with Jordan Peterson.
yeah.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about how did that sort of develop for you?
So for me, like, I was raised Lutheran technically. Like, my mom went to the Lutheran equivalent of catechism and like the parochial schools and all of that. And it was very much a part of her childhood. My dad was raised Catholic, converted to Lutheranism to marry my mom. But like, we only went to church on the holidays, really. So it wasn't a huge part of my life. And like, sort of just the biblical knowledge I have was what I picked up through cultural osmosis. And by middle school, really, I was just sort of like generally spiritual and kind of like all religions are true and everything is just looking at the same feature of the universe, but with a different perspective. And it was really the psychology stuff that kind of convinced me this probably know what's going on. So basically, the thing that it came down to was brain damage. If a person experiences the wrong type of brain damage, their personality can be changed drastically. Like, if their frontal lobe gets knocked out, and the frontal lobe is responsible for a lot of quote unquote higher cognitive function. So a lot of the social graces get their place in the frontal lobe. You lose that, you become, or typically you become, a more coarse person, more prone to anger, just a more difficult person to deal with. And yeah, so my conception prior to that was like, okay, a good person will go to like the good place, bad person will go to the bad place, wherever that may be. And then if somebody drastically changes personality through no fault of their own, they'd previously been a good person, whatever that means, and they were now more coarse and womanizing and like abusing drugs and doing like bad behaviors, what does that mean for their soul? Like, has their soul changed? Does the person who they were prior to an accident they had no control over, why are they being punished for all eternity? And I just could not get it to make sense. And so it was kind of like, or the more simpler and parsimonious explanation is that we are just the pink stuff floating around in our head and that's it. So that's sort of what brought me to atheism.
I guess that's a good lead in for what led you to maybe Jordan Peterson then.
So I've been watching YouTube for a while, and I kind of gravitated towards a couple of the YouTube atheist creators 4 years ago, 5 years ago. So the main channel was The Bible Reloaded, because it was like, cool, Bible study by atheists sounds, with memes and stuff, sounds great. And so they did like the Bible stuff, but they also, when 12 Rules came out, they went through it and like, this is hot garbage. And they were doing it from their perspective, which is largely like looking at Christian arguments, logic, apologetics, and sort of analyzing that. And so that was the angle that they took the book at. And I looked, and like, ContraPoints, Natalie Wynn, Mia Mulder, like a couple other people had sort of, oh, Ollie, PhilosophyTube, had looked at the book, but then talked about Peterson sort of on the whole. And I felt like there is a whole lot of science being done terrible injustices in this book. So why not talk about it, since that's my background?
And maybe we could talk about You're on what, roll 7 now in your deep dive video series. What has the experience been like thus far? You're doing the work that many of us can't bring ourselves to do in really diving into this book. I mean, I had trouble reading it.
Yeah. Well, like, my first encounter with it was trying to read the foreword, which was written by not Peterson, Norman Deutsch, who's a friend of Peterson, and just it was very uncomfortable to read. Like, just, oh, he's such a great moral man and he's so difficult, but I love him for it, blah blah blah, and it's like, okay, nope, next. Overture, because of course we can't just have like an introduction or chapter one, it's got to be the overture. And originally I took just notes after notes after notes with all of my thoughts, and it ended up being like 10 pages worth of notes for a handful of pages of Peterson's writing, and it's like, oh, this is off to a lovely start. Yeah, so it's been interesting. I kind of question if some people have even read the book. Like, I remember catching wind of PewDiePie doing, like, let's read this book, and him making some comment about he doesn't think that Peterson's a religious guy, and it's like, what? It is everywhere in this book. How can he not? How? Nope. Dude. Nope.
Yeah, he's oddly back and forth on that. Like, when he's asked about whether there's, like, like whether Jesus died for our sins and all of this, he never gives like a straight answer. He's like, well, it's possible. It's possible that there is like a literal God, but then he'll also say, well, you don't have to believe in an actual, you know, Christian God to be Christian. He's very it's odd. Everything he accuses the so-called postmodern neo-Marxists of doing, being sort of ambiguous and whatnot. It's sort of what he does himself a lot of times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was, so a couple people gave me his dissertation, and reading through it, it was just like, he got reined in hard, or something happened between that and 12 Rules, where he just got tenure and kind of went, wee! It's like, the dissertation is very much the normal, not, I don't want to say boring, but just utilitarian language that you tend to see in psychology, and especially in like research papers. And there were hints of the style madness on his acknowledgments page, where it was sort of like the weird and windy thought path. So it was always there, but I think he really got reined in by the people he was working with at that point. And now it's just, wait. And like, I can't say definitively like what his agenda is, like even saying what the target audience for this book is. Like, I'm sure he's all over the place about who it's for, but it's sort of very clearly for disenfranchised white men, typically younger. And yeah, but there's enough vagueness and uncertainty about what he's talking about, where it's just, is that his target audience? Because he's talking about having kids, and a lot of these guys like are kind of on the incel state of mind, which means they probably don't have kids, so why is this advice in here? And it just, the man is a puzzle.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember when he first got really popular, I was looking at his book, and I told you this off air before we started recording, but I was looking at his first book, which apparently he cites a lot in 12 Rules for Life.
Yeah, I'm getting to a point where I can call it like, oh, this must be a Maps of Meaning reference. Flip to the back. Yep, it is.
Well, I remember looking at Maps of Meaning when he first got popular. And I looked at it, I got a copy of it, and I opened it up, and the first thing I see is, he begins it with a quote from the Bible, Matthew 13:35, And he just says, I will utter things which have been kept secret from the foundation of the world. And I just sort of closed it and said to myself, this feels like we're going into, like, cult leader territory. Not saying that Jordan Peterson is a cult leader or aspiring cult leader, but it just weirded me out. Mm-hmm. I was like, how is this guy so popular? It just sounds like he's preaching in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, I call that angry Peterson in particular, where it's like, you should be living this way. Why are you not living this way? This is why you're suffering and falling down the nihilism pathway and blah, 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 where he's just like, you can almost feel him yelling at you, like wanting to shake you. Like, what are you doing? You're not living your life right. It's like, oh my God, no. This is supposed to be like helpful, not telling me I'm broken and flawed and, let's see, chaotic because I'm feminine and all this other stuff. It just, what? No.
Well, I guess the next thing I would ask then is, so you're from a cognitive psych background. Peterson, at times he almost sounds like he's an evolutionary psych sort of guy, mm-hmm. But I believe he actually comes from psychoanalysis, particularly mm-hmm. Jung. So maybe we should talk a little bit about Freud and Jung and the bone you have to pick with them that you mentioned earlier.
Well, yeah. So Freud and Jung and so they were, let's see, psychoanalysis and psychodynamics founders way back when. Well, not way back when, grand scheme of things, fairly recent. And their views on how people work got very popular, more so for Freud than for Jung. Jung is sort of like the hipster version of Freud, probably, with like, oh yeah, it's this psychologist guy, but you probably haven't heard of him.
See, I'm even more hipster than that. I always liked reading Wilhelm Reich because he's like really, really out there.
Yeah. So the big bone I have to pick with basically like anybody after Freud, like of that mindset, is a lot of, especially Freud's theory, and there have been adjustments made to the psychoanalytic approach to try to make it less this, but basically it's not good science. It makes predictions that aren't falsifiable, which means that in practice, like the structure of personality, he says that there's the id, the ego, and the superego, and the id is largely housed in your unconscious mind and does stuff and makes you do things that you aren't aware of. The ego is sort of like you operating in the world with reality. And the superego is like the angel on the shoulder trying to get you to be your best self. And he says that, you know, at different stages in your life, the id is in control or the ego is in control. And that if you don't resolve certain conflicts that happen at different stages in your life, you're going to have different neuroses or psychoses as a consequence of that. But then you have people who would not appear to resolve the conflict appropriately, who grow up just fine. And so that should falsify or at least put boundaries on like reaction formation or other mechanisms of stuff behind the psychoanalytic approach. But there's always like, oh, well, they resolved the conflict properly because of this, or, oh, they didn't resolve the conflict properly, but they just haven't had the necessary bad experience for the neurosis to occur. Or like, there's always just this reason that explains it, but by adding all these little reasons, you lose all falsifiability and you lose the good science endorsement. And I've had a couple comment discussions on some of the videos with people where like, okay, fine, it's bad science, but it's still useful as a counseling approach or whatever. And I disagree with them because in my opinion, if you're doing counseling and trying to help people, you should really have a good, solid scientific foundation behind why you're helping him the way you are. And like Jung, it's an approach that I think has some potentially very harmful consequences, where you go in and you try to recover memories that have been repressed through hypnosis, and it's just, you're asking for trouble. Like,
are you familiar with, there was this whole thing in the 80s called the Satanic Panic?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've done a few shows on that, and the whole recovered memory syndrome and all of this crazy stuff sort of has to do with, you know, people believing they got recovered memories of satanic abuse.
Yep.
And they got these recovered memories back through hypnosis. And then, yep, it all turned out that was all BS.
Yep, yep. Definitely going to be talking about some of the work that Elizabeth Loftus, a cognitive psychologist who focuses on memory, did on recovered memories, where she was able to induce false memories in, I think, about a third, typically, of her population of participants, where just, here's a memory that we have verified did not happen by your parents, and through the course of the experiment, we're able to get people to believe that it actually happened to them. And it could be a fairly benign memory, like going up in a hot air balloon or something, or being lost in the mall. I think that was the most traumatizing they went. I might be wrong there. Because you have to be careful with the ethics. Like, you don't want to have a bunch of undergrad participants coming in and then leaving the experiment believing that they were part of a satanic cult when they were a kid. Like, there's boundaries. There's ethical boundaries. They're there for a reason. It's a good thing. But yeah, definitely want to talk about her research, because like, I wish we could get away from therapists and psychotherapists and psychoanalysts and people using those techniques. Like, I'm sure the majority of people who use those techniques aren't doing it with the intent to do harm, or at least I'd hope not. But if they aren't aware that they are leading with questions, or the person is in an incredibly vulnerable state where they're more likely to go along with things that they don't think happened, like, yeah, bad things can happen.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, about Freud. I've always found Freud interesting, but I'm one of those people that looks at it more philosophically. That's probably a cop-out, but like, I thought he built interesting models, but you can't really prove those models.
Yeah.
You know, and in part, that's probably because, I mean, he's working on things with a lot of, before we have a lot of knowledge in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's good to question, you know, sacred cows like Freud, mm-hmm, which I think has been happening for the past few decades.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and like, there's Neo-Freudian people who've tried to cut off sort of the unfortunate parts of Freudian theory because of the time period. Like in my video on Freud, I talk about a couple of his case studies, and one of them, just when I learned about it, like, I was infuriated and passed that on to my students when I taught intro psych, of just Dora being a teenaged girl coming to him because her dad was making her. And the inciting incident was Dora's dad's friend, who's the dad's age, hit on Dora, like, hey, baby, like, you're hot, or whatever the 19th century Viennese equivalent of that would be. And her rejecting his advances and, like, slapping him because she was, like, so offended. And Dora's dad and the other guy both being like, oh, you're imagining it. Like, what's going on? And Freud, in going through this hysterical response she was having as a consequence of this, just being like, you liked it. You're only feeling this because you want to have sex with your dad's friend or your dad. And you need to resolve those conflicts, and, you know, just kind of enabling the situation in a really just gross way. Yeah.
I have to be honest, one of the things that makes me uncomfortable with Freud is I think with a lot of psychoanalysis, there can be a sort of conservative or even authoritarian vibe that I get from it at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you'd agree with that or if you have any comment on that. I know it's a little bit removed from the scientific aspect.
Well, I think it kind of, I mean, really, any person who is treating people who are coming to them, like, help me, there's something in my life that isn't working, like, there's already a huge power imbalance there. And with the psychoanalytic approach, like, you're supposed to see the therapist every week for years, for however long it takes to get through all this stuff and for you to move on with your life. And, yeah, so it's like there's a lot of a power imbalance with the psychoanalyst sort of being put up on this pedestal of like, I'm going to tell you what you're thinking and you don't know you're thinking. And it, yeah, it's not exactly the best power dynamic to go into for healing, I think.
Doesn't Peterson basically say that in 12 Rules for Life? Like, I know you better than you know yourself sort of thing? Okay.
Well, I mean, let me think. It's usually like you don't know yourself. And I don't know if I'm not remembering any instances so far where he said, like, I know you better than you do, except maybe on the atheism thing. But it's always like, you're too complicated to fully understand yourself. And then there's the implication that he does. And it's the hard thing in going through his writing is there's so much on this implication level. And that's why in my videos, like, I'll do these huge quotes, because it's like, to me, there's a huge implication of, like, he's talking about trans people violating some natural biological order that was born with, and they're doing this as an act of rebellion or something. And it's just, it's in the subtext, and that keeps them safe. It's so frustrating.
And I guess the other thing I wanted to get into before we really dissect some of the roles is the influence of Jung mm-hmm. on, I keep saying Jung, I should be saying Jung.
Well, I don't know. It's the pronunciation I was taught. So, who knows if it's good or not?
Well, maybe for listeners that are unfamiliar with Jung, how would you sort of sum it up? I guess the big aspect of his work that Peterson sort of cribs is the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm. Among other things, yeah. So with Jung, okay. So Freud, there was the id, the ego, and superego, and that was the parts of your personality. Jung had a different approach where basically he still kept sort of like the unconscious as this nebulous thing that could influence your behavior, especially if you weren't doing the work to try to minimize or direct its influence. But instead of sort of just the id being this little hedonistic part of you, Jung said that you have these archetypes, which are sort of just caricatures of different parts of life. So like the hero, the mother, the son, the witch, like there's just these personality types or traits that are floating around in your unconscious. You've inherited these from your species. And the mechanism that happens, I'm unclear on. And these influence your behavior. And so part of growing up and maturing is going through a hero's journey where you, as a young person, typically man, is the influence or the perspective of these stories. And you have to face off against your mother figure and maybe kill her in a cave or something. And in doing this process, you'll come out wiser and differentiated from your parents and a fully fledged adult capable of thinking on your own. Which is fun, I guess. And I'm not sure, again, with the vagueness of Peterson's writing, where it's like, I think he's talking about some sort of Jung thing here, where part of Jung's development model for people is the ending period of our life that not everybody gets to is like this spiritual stage where you lose the emphasis on material things in the world and you start to see your place in the grand scheme of things and that you are a divine being in a fleshy body and you prepare for that next stage of your life. And I feel like Peterson's sort of kind of touched on that a couple times, but it's in such a vague way that it's like, is he? I think he is. Maybe. But then it's not clear and just, ugh.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Peterson, because of this sort of connection to Jung, he sort of has a foothold in the world of like psychedelic bros, you mm-hmm. know, that listen to like Joe Rogan, mm-hmm. who are really into, oh yeah, mystic Carl Jung, occultism. But he also has a foothold with the sort of Christian conservative crowd as mm-hmm. well. It's odd because he seems to attract sort of both worlds, even though they seem very much not even opposed, but just different.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's like the early rules, when he's talking about Bible stories, he has more of an attempt at like, oh, this is just a story, but let's talk about it because there's important lessons to be taken from it. But Rule 6, I really felt like he stopped trying to hedge it. Like, we're just going to talk the Bible because this is like one of the crowning achievements of Western civilization, and we need to embrace it rather than walk away from it. So yeah, like if you can get people on board with the weird psychedelic, like let's talk about order and chaos and masculine and feminine, and this is relevant to the Bible because blah, 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 and get them on board and get them in, then maybe PewDiePie just didn't notice the greater and greater emphasis on things, but I mean, PewDiePie is a whole other discussion, I'm sure.
Well, what of the rules really stuck out to you, and maybe as a cognitive psychologist made you go, I don't know about that.
as a cognitive psychologist, let's see, was it Rule 2? Yeah, when he goes on like this whole big kick about like perception, and we have these two fundamental categories, and they are masculine and feminine, and every other category is built on those categories. And it's like, we could test for that. Like, I could design an experiment to test for that. But like, there's no mention of that. And it's just, why would all of our categories, including perceptual categories, boil down to masculine or feminine? Like, it doesn't make sense to me. And it just like, what? From a general science perspective, like Rule 1 was just, okay, so this is what I have to look for in the book, with him talking about like lobster dominance hierarchies and how when lobsters battle to be at the top of the dominance hierarchy, if they lose, their brain dissolves, which is not, like, he cited a paper, and I thank him for citing that paper, but just, their brains don't dissolve. No. Like, what? How is he getting this from that paper? I don't understand.
I mean, is it really even, I've always been warned by people that you shouldn't really necessarily compare animals and humans.
Well, I mean, you can get some stuff from that, and like, yeah, it's a little bristling that dominance hierarchies are reinforced by serotonin or whatever, but there does seem to be pretty good evidence that serotonin does play a role in like the social hierarchy, I guess, if you want to call it that. But yeah, with going from animal models to humans, you have to be careful. And there have, like with the serotonin stuff, there have been tests on, you know, if you think you just beat somebody, you might get a little boost of serotonin and like your brain saying good job. But yeah, just you got to be careful. And same thing with like evolutionary psychology. You got to be careful on what you do and how you do it to make sure you're getting a good interpretation of things and you're not just telling a just-so story of why males tend to be bigger than females and more muscular.
I was curious about that. I don't think you've done like a whole video necessarily on evolutionary psychology, but I'm curious what you think of that field, because I've been very critical of it, but I'm also not someone that is an expert, so maybe I shouldn't always be so harsh.
Yeah. So I think there's interesting theories about like human sexual selection, or like the size difference on average between men and women, or even weird things like the shape and size and relative proportion of different genitalia compared to like close animal relatives or further animal relatives. And there's interesting things to be said and speculated on, but these are things that, unless you're very crafty, are very hard to test. And because they're hard to test, it's hard to have a good, solid scientific basis behind things. And certainly, there are good evolutionary psychology people out there doing amazing work, but it seems like a lot of it is armchair philosophy with, like, some motion of an experiment to back it up, and it's just, what? Like, the one that is jumping to mind for me is the one that argued that strippers, menstruating or like at the ovulation phase of their cycle were tipped more or something. And I remember the backlash against that with strippers being like, hey, how about you talk to us instead of just observe? Like, we can tell you when we get tipped more. And it's when there's conventions in town, especially like conservative conventions, they love the strip joints. And so, yeah, like having their input, the strippers' input would have been very helpful in analyzing the experiments instead of just like doing it without any intelligence sort of what the job is like and what they think is going on.
Well, it's interesting because I think at times Peterson sort of cribs from evolutionary psychology, but I think there is a lot of that just-so story stuff going on. I mean, you can use the lobster example and say, oh, see, everyone should be dominant and, you know, all men should be aggressive and fighting for the you know, being at the top of the hierarchy. So he gets all the girls at the end, as Peterson sort of writes. But I mean, you know, you can also make arguments for why something like, you know, why more timid men exist. I mean, there's probably an evolutionary argument for that as well. Mm-hmm. I like how, maybe you could talk a little bit about this. You mentioned the cuttlefish in sort of contrast to Peterson's lobsters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know of research with cuttlefish and then even like birds that mate for life or tend to be not pairing up with many different birds in the course of their mating life. And you do genetic studies of who the parent should be. And yeah, like, okay. So with cuttlefish, you have the female cuttlefish doing the cute little, like, I'm a cuttlefish, and with their little skirt thing. And then the male cuttlefish coming in and like, rawr, I'm a dominant cuttlefish and I'm going to mate with this female cuttlefish. And some males who aren't the big ones and aren't the aggressive ones have a strategy of like, teehee, I'm also a girl cuttlefish. I'm just going to hang out with my girlfriend right here. underneath the big alpha male, slip a little sperm packet, and then just leave before it's figured out what's going on. And so the female cuttlefish can, like, do I want the big aggressive one or do I want the sneaky smart one? And sort of discard one of the sperm packets depending on what she prefers. And yeah, so like this sneaky, sexy shenanigans show that, you know, it's not always about being the biggest lobster. There's some craftiness and subterfuge involved, even where you have something where, like, this one is the dominant one, it should have the babies, and it doesn't have all the babies. So, yeah.
I was gonna say with the more timid men thing, I've always thought to myself, I'm like, you know, maybe the reason there would be men that are more timid is because they're less likely to get into fights and get killed and yada, mm-hmm. yada, yada. So maybe that's the evolutionary reason for that. But I don't think Peterson would necessarily make that argument.
Yeah.
But you can do a lot of these kind of sort of just-so things, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I guess before we start wrapping up, the other thing that I noticed in your deep dive so far is that there's a lot of moments where Peterson does not make a lot of citations, but he makes a lot of big claims.
Oh, yeah.
How often have you come across that? I think at a certain point, you came across it in the first few rules, and then you started noting it a little bit less because it just became too much at times.
Well, so something that I'm trying to be careful with is not just going nuts with the citation needed thing I've got in the video. And, like, I've been trying to make a distinction between this sounds like a claim that should be based on evidence and should have some sort of citation backing it up versus this is opinion, which it'd be nice to have an informed opinion, but okay, he doesn't need to necessarily have the same backing on this. Like, I'm trying to be mindful of people watching this video coming in and being on Peterson's side, coming in and wanting to hate this and wanting to look for reasons to discredit me. And if I start just going nuts with the citation needed, I've lost somebody who could have otherwise engaged with my material. And yeah, so I try to do it when I feel like this is absolutely a strong claim that needs to have evidence behind it. Something that's going to be interesting with Rule 7, which is, like, my little sticky of it's, you're not the boss of me, which is helpful. Pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. And just so much of this chapter is Bible stuff and claims based on, like, Christian apologetics. And, yeah, like, he cites the Bible, so good job there. But it just, it's, yeah, when you get into sort of the biblical allusions or that sort of thing, I don't feel as warranted in going nuts with the citation needed. So, yeah, it's sort of based on his argument.
I feel like the citations were really needed on the lobster stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So much of it is, he's sort of applying, I don't know if anthropomorphizing is the right word, but he's sort of applying intentions to these lobsters when, you know, we really don't know what is going on.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, his, yeah, the anthropomorphizing of the lobsters is a bit much with, like, going on this whole big thing about the losing lobster. You know, he's got his shoulders down and he feels defeated with his face towards the ground and this poor thing, like, feels like the biggest loser because he just lost, blah, 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 blah. Whereas, like, if you are a lobster going up against another lobster and you lose, it makes sense for your brain to be wired to, like, not keep trying because that'll get you killed. Like, it's not this lobster feeling dejected. It's this lobster is going to live another day and possibly mate with some other female lobsters. Like, it's absurd.
What do you think about sort of his views on women, or maybe what you have gotten out of that in the book so far?
I haven't, so some of the early rules, like, especially the rule where he went off about, like, masculine is order and feminine is chaos, and it's been this way since the Garden of Eden and blah, 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 and women make men self-conscious. If it wasn't for women, men wouldn't be self-conscious of themselves. And it's like, ugh, no, stop it. Bad Peterson. And the, like, there's a general trend that I haven't called out in the videos where in scientific writing, it's typically a good idea to try to either be non-specific on gender when it's not relevant or have equal representations across different conditions. So sometimes you have a man doing positive things, sometimes you have a woman doing positive things, sometimes a man's doing negative things or a woman doing negative things. And like the parenting chapter, it seemed like it was always the mom who was messing up, who wasn't disciplining the child and leading to problems down the road. And then Peterson was the good parent and he did the good appropriate things and spanked his or flicked his child when they weren't doing something right or whatever. And it just, I'm not sure if it's intentional on his part. And that's so much of his writing. Like, is this intentional that the negative things tend to be the women and the positive things tend to be the men? Or is this just something he's writing because it's what makes sense to him and it's a bias coming out in the way he's writing? And it's so hard to know.
It's interesting on the parenting issue. I think you were fairly diplomatic about it, but the science is not really on his side when it comes to, like, this is how you should punish your children.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the American Pediatric Association, the UN, and then as a consequence, the World Health Organization are all on the side of corporal punishment. So spanking, rulers, flicking, like all of that is not conducive to good parenting. Like, and there's experiments detailing the outcomes, and even some that Peterson cited, talking about how, like, spanking or using the belt or a switch or whatever leads to poorer outcomes for the child when they grow up than using something like positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement, even just not smacking your kids. And there's a huge difference that he just kind of didn't talk about, even though he cited one of the papers talking about that, which, of course, why am I surprised?
It's always funny to me because people will say, well, I was spanked as a kid and I, you know, I turned out okay. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, you may be an exception to a rule. I don't know. But I mean, the studies seem to show the opposite is generally true. Mm-hmm. It's odd how people will personalize scientific studies.
Yeah. Well, it's like I even had a discussion with my husband at one point, I forget when it came up, about, you know, physical discipline. Cause like it was very much not a thing in my household because my dad had the snot beaten out of him by his dad and was like, we are not doing that. And my husband says it was on the table in his childhood, but only remembers one incident of being spanked. And he turned out fine and, you know, he thought it was appropriate and everything else. And it's like, but okay, so it was once for you. So it doesn't really sound like it was something your parents used often. Whereas I think a lot of people who use corporal punishment, like minor transgressions and you get a spanking. And just reading like Reddit, so many people talking about how much it hurt them and how resentful they were of their parents for doing that to them. And like, it's not consequence free. And I think a lot of people assume it is, especially like when they're in their 40s or 50s and reminiscing with their siblings about going out and having to cut their own switch out of the yard. And it was a whole big thing and they're laughing about it now, but that would have been horrifying. And it's to think, to put it in a context that you can cope with it and deal with it, like, I understand, but whoa, doing that to your own child, like, how, no.
Do you have a little bit more time? I just wanted to cover maybe one or two more things.
Sure.
Well, I wanted to say one of the interesting things about this deep dive, I think at times it's hard to criticize 12 Rules for Life because of how, I'm just going to say, slippery that Peterson can be, or Dr. P. and the other thing is, like, some of the rules, like, on the surface, they don't really sound that bad. Stand up straight with your shoulders back. Okay. Make friends with people who want the best for you. That sounds, you know, good. And then four, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. I'm like, oh, that's good advice. But then I get to one like six. Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. And I just think to myself, that has like some really dark implications. Because no one's house is ever in perfect order.
Right.
So you can't criticize anything.
Right. Yeah. And that's something I kind of go into with the videos of just, it's an impossible threshold to meet. And is he saying this with the intention of getting people sort of disengaged from trying to make the world a better place? Or is it just he thinks that all the social justice warriors need to take a step back and look at their own lives before continuing on with the progressivism? Because it does seem, I know he says he's a centrist, but no, he's well in the conservative camp with arguing that we should return to the West's old ways and our ancestors knew more than we do today and all these claims. And even like the benign rules of like make friends who want the best for you, like the surface message, fine. Yeah, that's great. You should want be friends with people who want the best for you. But then you dig into the advice and it's very reader-centric or Peterson-centric of like, you should have friends who want the best for you and want you to improve and will hold you accountable and stuff, but never about how to be a better friend for other people. It's just self-serving advice and sort of the universe exists to serve you and not really you going out and helping other people in any way. And it's just, yeah, it's very, I could see it. I don't want to say it's coddling the reader necessarily, but it's definitely like, you know, life is suffering, you're flawed, and you follow this advice and life will be bearable. And it's
always interesting to me how when I've looked at self-help books, it's always fascinated me just from an aesthetic standpoint of how when I've looked at self-help books, I'm like, half the time the self-help book makes you feel like crap. Because that's why you're reading it, probably, you know, and then it's like, well, do this and then you'll feel better. But you won't keep buying the self-help books unless they make you feel like crap a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think I've said it a couple places in the video series, like this is the first self-help book I've read. So I don't really know what the genre norms are. And actually got in a debate in the comment section with somebody about whether or not this is actually a self-help book. Apparently on, I think it's Amazon, this is listed in finance. And on Barnes & Noble, it's just a book. Like, it's not in any category. So it's definitely something fishy going on in the back end to keep it out of self-help. But my friend Lily, who I talk about periodically on the channel, she was in a horribly abusive, manipulative relationship for over 10 years. And she got out of it. And I talk about that in a video that will never, ever be monetized, understandably, because, you know, we're talking about psychological abuse. And so she's done a fair bit of reading of self-help books, specifically on how to not end up in that type of relationship again. And at least for those type of books, she does sometimes feel bad, but it's more in a context of like, empathizing with some story that's being told and seeing herself back in that abusive relationship and feeling bad in that way, but these books really pushing towards growth. And yeah, I think maybe a weird circumstance in that, at this point, she's sort of come to terms with being codependent and trying to get beyond that. But in the early stages, and even still, she's buying just all these different books, trying to understand more, trying to, you know, figure out this one little question she's had in the back of her mind that these other books haven't answered so far, and maybe this one will. And I mean, she was, when she was still living with the guy, but fully intending to move out, but not letting him know because it, who knows how it would have gone. Like, she was devouring books and podcasts and YouTube and just everything. And so maybe in that market, people can afford to be positive and not like, you're broken and you should feel bad, because the audience is very much just going to seek out every piece of information they can. And maybe this book will explain it in a way that will make things click together so that they can finally move on with their life and not feel at risk of it happening again. When I honestly kind of think that part of it is just, there's always a risk with relationships with other people, and it's, you just have to be careful and be willing to cut it off when things could turn bad. But that's not a comforting answer.
I think the other thing that's been interesting about this deep dive into 12 Rules for Life is something that's always fascinated me about Peterson, is that he engages in a lot of, I mean, I would just call it victim blaming, mm-hmm. but you were the first person I noticed that used the just world hypothesis to sort of explain maybe why he thinks that way. Maybe you could describe the just world hypothesis and how it ties into your reading of Peterson.
Yeah, okay. So the just world hypothesis, phenomenon, belief, I mean, I've seen it called any number of things, is basically this bias that we tend to have where we think that the world is a just and fair place and people get what's coming to them. So if somebody ends up in an accident, in a bad relationship, losing their job, you know, something negative happens to them, we tend to assume they did something warranting that action. It can't just be the company was downsizing and they were in a division that is no longer there. We tend to tell ourselves like, oh, that won't happen to us because we're good workers and we're valued by our company, and just sort of self-soothing thoughts that make the other person look bad and put them at fault for their problems. And
it reminds me, not to interrupt you, but it reminds me of the, I remember I was talking to someone about the Brock Turner, case, and they were saying, well, Brock Turner, what he did was horrible, but you know, the sister should have stayed with her, and you know, you shouldn't get blackout drunk at parties. And I'm like, even if you get blackout drunk and even if your sister leaves, you shouldn't have to have your body violated. You shouldn't have to have your, you shouldn't even have to think, oh, well, that could happen if I black out, or that could happen if I leave my sister, maybe something will happen to her. You shouldn't even have to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really know what to say to that. And I was like, it's just victim blaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it just, I mean, that case was horrific. Like the victim statement at the end, just how she was found and the effects it had on her were just, oh my God. But yeah, like they're in the quote unquote culture war, part of it is centered around like consent. And I think on the anti-progressive side, there is a lot of victim blaming of like, you know, women are fully accountable for how they're dressed and men can't help it. And just a lot of toxic gender roles and expectations and just ugliness wrapped up in all these statements. And it'd be nice if we could move past those and get to a point where people aren't having sex with people who are drunk, you know, even if they, prior to getting to that point, were like fully on board. If they're not responding to you, maybe don't have sex with them. And yeah, like I kind of can almost understand people being worried about like fake or rape charges being brought against them because they didn't realize that consent was withdrawn. But I think the conditions for that to occur are rare enough that hopefully that's not something that happens a lot. But just if we got better about talking about like consent and not having this expectation that somebody's dress means that they're down for things that they may not be, or you need to worry about parties and getting drunk enough that like your ability to remember goes out the window. Like, yeah, it's a lot of badness. It'd be nice if we could move past and have people not see it as attack on Western civilization by asking to improve like our consent talks.
Well, in regards to that just world, I've also heard it called the just world fallacy. I kind of like that terming for it. Have there been any studies that you're aware of that sort of, like, I'd be interested to know how you break through that sort of cognitive fallacy that people have. I'm not sure there's been much work on that, though.
So I know there's a lot of experiments on the effect itself and the bias or the fallacy, where just, like, if somebody thinks that, like, a person deserved, like, being assaulted or something, they're less sympathetic for them or less likely to help them. I imagine there's probably been research done on trying to get people to not think that way or to be more empathetic and things, but it's not coming to mind for me right now. But it has to have been done.
I think that's fair. I mean, what's always interested me about the just world stuff is, it seems that a lot of people have a just world sort of outlook until it's applied to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for me, not the type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And of course, because it's like there's the just world effect and then there's fundamental attribution error is sort of related to that, what you're talking about, where people are much more forgiving on themselves, and because we know what's going on in our lives and the situation for why we're doing things, but we don't know that for other people. And so because we know, like, we ran that light because we're trying to get to the hospital because something bad happened, whereas we see someone else run a light and like, oh my god, that person's a maniac, they're gonna get somebody killed. Like, you don't know what's going on and you make judgments about that person and their character based on external things and not knowing the internal context. Whereas for ourselves, we know that and tend to be much more like, oh, I did everything I can or I could, but I still failed that test. You know, I studied hard, but I failed. That sucks. Whereas somebody else failed, like, you shouldn't have been partying and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah.
It's one of the reasons that, how do I put this? When it came out recently that Jordan Peterson was having addiction issues, because his wife had, of course, cancer, and he got hooked on, I guess, anti-anxiety meds, and he had to go into rehab. And congratulations to him for doing that. But my initial response, and a lot of people took this as being more mean-spirited than it really was, but I was sort of the view of, well, I hope he gets better, but, you know, who is he to, like, go into rehab when he's telling everyone else to bootstrap?
Yeah.
You know, and I think it ties into that just world thing and the sort of for me, not the type mentality.
Yeah. Well, and, like, so I watched his daughter's video where she announced, like, Peterson was going into rehab because he was on clonazepam, and he tried coming off it cold turkey, which, oh my God, what are you doing? This is clonazepam and other benzodiazepines. You run the risk, like, if you, depending on the dose and the duration, you run the risk of giving yourself seizures, going cold turkey, or even possibly death. Like, that his psychiatrist, apparently, according to the daughter, signed off on him doing this is just no. And like I said in the little video thing I did on that, like, he should have known better. He really should have known better than trying to cold turkey it. And it's totally understandable that, like, to me, especially because I'm on anxiety meds, like, I am physically addicted or dependent on those drugs at this point. I do go into withdrawal when I've gone too long without a dose. That's how we work. That's how neurotransmitters work. And so him needing to go into a facility to help him come off those drugs, like, it makes sense. His attempt didn't work. He needs somebody to help him do it. And I'm definitely going to be interested to see how this is talked about in the future by him. Because maybe a month after he went in and his daughter made the video, she released another video where it was vague. Maybe it runs in the family. But she was talking about her dad needing to go into the hospital, but it was okay. It was an allergic reaction. And so I'm not sure if she was sort of correcting the narrative for that hospital visit or for the rehab visit, or if there was a separate incident that happened that didn't make the news that she was talking about. So it'll be interesting to see, because he's got another self-help book coming. It should be out early next year. That, yeah, how he talks about it and what the narrative is. And I think I'm still stupidly, cautiously optimistic that he'll take this as a teaching moment. And, you know, sometimes we do need help and we need assistance from others. And psychopharmacological agents can be that thing, and it's okay. But I imagine that's not how it'll go.
Yeah, that brings me to my sort of last point I wanted to get to. One thing that always worried me about Peterson and his influence early on, and I talked to Dr. Bernard Schiff, the psychologist who hired him at the University of Toronto, about this when I interviewed him for Zero Books. I always sort of detected more than a whiff of social Darwinism in Peterson's sort of worldview. But at the same time, when you actually look into 12 Rules for Life, I just started realizing, I'm like, a lot of this is, like, really incoherent in a way. There's a lot of contradictions at the heart of this book.
Yeah. So something I'll talk about in Rule 7 is, I think I finally hit on maybe the source of that. Because there's a couple typos that would make sense if he was dictating this. Like, they're homophone mistakes. And I'm surprised an editor didn't catch them, but maybe the editor just wasn't reading it either. But if he dictates this stuff and doesn't really sit down and go back to things, like, it's easier to make contradictions like that. And it also would explain just sort of the flow of consciousness way this can feel, where it just, there's weird run-on sentences or comma splicing or other weird things where if he's saying it, like, that makes sense. And yeah, so that's a pet theory of mine, but yeah, it would be nice to have a logically consistent book with this, and just especially like Rule 6, which is basically glass houses, and Rule 7, where just, like, he's contradicting himself. Like, he said the world worked in this way previously, and now he's talking about working in a different way. And it's like, pick a lane.
Were there any particular contradictions that really stood out to you? I know you mentioned, I forget what it was in reference to, but you mentioned how opposed he was to the trans community. But you made some reference in regards to what he was saying, and you said, oh, you mean like trans people fighting for their rights.
Right.
I forget what it was in reference to, though.
It's come up a couple times. So him, I think it was probably role one with the stand up straight with your shoulders back, say what you mean, say what you need, stand up for yourself. And it's just like, okay, so like these students that you insist on misgendering, they're standing up for themselves, what they think, what they need, what they believe. They're following your advice, essentially, but you won't honor their request. And it's just like, it's frustrating where it just, if he would take a step back and think about what he's saying and understand that, like, trans or non-binary people, like, they're not doing this as an act of rebellion. This is their truth, and he's all about living your truth. It's like the cognitive dissonance just must be off the chart. Like, how can he give this advice and not think about other people?
Yeah, that brings me to an interesting sort of wrapping up point here. And that's, a lot of people have said, whenever you criticize Peterson, he'll always have his fans say, why are you such a hater? He's helped so many people. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I can't quantify how many people he's helped. I also can't quantify how many people may have been hurt by Peterson. I don't know if there's guys that read 12 Rules for Life and then, you know, took it as like, oh, women are horrible, and decided to abuse their girlfriend or something. I don't know either way. I can't quantify how much good it's done or how much bad it's done. So I don't know what to think about that criticism.
Yeah. Well, and so the variant of criticism I've gotten the most is, you just don't understand him. Like, you need to watch the hours upon hours of lectures and read Mass Meaning before you talk about this book and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, this is supposed to be a standalone book. It shouldn't need 20 or 30 hours of back lecture to be able to understand what he's getting at. No.
I mean, I have to be honest with you. I can't watch half of those lectures.
I know.
I don't want to watch a whole lecture on, you know, I don't need a professor to explain the tenets and merits and deeper meanings of Lion King to me.
Yeah. But yeah, with people saying like, oh, you're just haters and you don't understand him, and like, he's helped so many people, like, maybe he has, and I touch on this at one point where just in Rule 6, he does a fair amount of quoting of school shooters or mass shooters, and it felt very out of place to me and inappropriate. And just, if he is reaching people who could otherwise go down like the black pill ideology path and get them to sort of pull up their bootstraps, bucko, or whatever, like, then I guess it's kind of doing a good, kind of. But again, hopefully, optimistically, you know, they read this, they kind of not go down the dark path, and then maybe at some point later they can outgrow this. Certainly a couple people on, who are now subscribers, have said that, like, you know, they were either starting to go down the Peterson path, or they were down there and saw my videos and just like, oh no. And then kind of reevaluated stuff and came out of that rabbit hole. And yeah, so hopefully it's a stepping stone and not like a final point for people, but who knows?
There's times where he feels very black pill himself in the book, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you know, life is suffering. But then at the end, he says, I think it's at the end of Rule 6, he says, but we should accept the goodness of being. I'm like, I thought you were against positive psychology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. like, oh, any person who's living a lie, that's such a bleak philosophy. But then he says to do that, like, okay, that's fine, I guess. Everything's fine.
I guess in closing, maybe you could tell my listeners about some work that you're doing in the future with the YouTube channel and any positive vibes. I always like to end on a positive note. Any positive vibes you can give to my listeners?
So future stuff for a channel, like I was saying, going to touch more on the scientific-y side of psychology and less on the counseling side for a little bit. Going to see some overlap with sort of exploring religious things, like the neurological correlates for religious experience. So exploring a couple of the papers there, and there's a police car going by, because of course. And yeah, like, definitely planning on talking about his next book when that comes out and having a field day there, because I'm sure it's not going to see a drastically improved citation style at the very least. And one thing, and maybe it's just the size of my channel and I'm being naively optimistic again, but for the most part, like, my YouTube comment community and Twitter experiences have been pretty positive. Like, people who have come to disagree with me, like, it's been civil, and like, only a couple people have resorted to just like name calling or personal attacks, and I've only blocked one person, and that's because they were very insistent that I needed to have children and it would fix my life, and that I wasn't wanting children indicated my repressed something or other, and it's like, nope, done, blocked.
Can I comment on that real quick? I was at the bar a while back, and the one bartender was talking to me about how she made her decision. She's not having children. And someone said to her, an older woman said, oh, well, you'll change your mind. And I just thought to myself, do you guys ever think how condescending that sounds?
Yeah.
Like you're telling her what she's going to think in the future. I really hope that mentality changes at some point. Maybe with younger generations it will.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, and just the video that I've got coming out tomorrow, where I talk about psychiatry and my experience with psychiatrists. Two of the three psychiatrists I've had pushed me to have children, that it would improve things and change my life and make it better, where it's like, I know for a fact that my dad's mother got postpartum depression. I've got bipolar. Like, there is no way I would get out of a pregnancy without some form of like postpartum badness. And like, I have many reasons for not wanting to have children, and just how many times I've had to defend myself. It's crazy. And I want to say it's mostly come from older people, but it's come certainly from people in their 30s too. So change hasn't fully trickled down yet.
And as I said, I always like to end on a positive note. I don't know if there's any positive vibes. We went a little bit dark there with that discussion there at the end, but
Like, I have had people sort of who were on board the Peterson lobster train or whatever come out of it. So certainly somebody who is a Peterson believer isn't fated to be that way until the end of time. Like, they can take a look around and get a different perspective and take a different read on it and kind of question what they're reading. Both Peterson, me, the media in general, and probably be a more conscious consumer of their material and what they choose to focus their energies on. So that's good.
Well, I think your approach to it is helpful too. I just want to note that real quick, because I think people like me, I can be a little bit of a I can be very snarky about Jordan Peterson. I can also get very just annoyed with his fans. And that's not the way to reach them. I think what you're doing is probably much more liable to reach Peterson's fan base than anything I do.
Yeah. Well, I found out through somebody helpfully linking me that one of my videos showed up in their subreddit, in the official Peterson subreddit, and looking at the comments was interesting. Like, I think maybe one person watched more than a minute of my video. But most of them were like 10 seconds in and like, she's got crazy eyes. This grads, like, are grad students being paid so poorly now that they have to go onto YouTube? And it's like, oh, you don't know how many levels, you're wrong. Yeah, and that was interesting. But I mean, it was frustrating that they weren't engaging with my ideas. It was just like written off, not engaging. Like, could you at least engage with the ideas? I gave a timestamp for you to skip my snarky introduction. Just, I would love to hear discussion from the other side. And other than like maybe two people, it hasn't happened. It's just quick attacks and then they're gone.
Well, I'm looking forward to the rest of the deep dive you're doing into Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. Could you tell my listeners how they can find your YouTube, Twitter, get in contact with you, anything good like that?
Yeah, so I was able to get like the little custom handle-y thing. I'm trying to see if I can. It's basically Google or search in YouTube for Cass Eris, E-R-I-S, and you'll find me. But it's also youtube.com/C/CassErisYT, I think. I'm also CassErisYT at Twitter. I have an Instagram that gets cat pictures recently. Yeah. I've also got a Discord, but that link is so long and weird that it's in my description box on the videos. But yeah, love to hear from people.
Also, support Cass Eris on Patreon.
Yes. Yes. Patrons are good. I do a monthly live stream for patrons. And yeah. And my cat is throwing up. Nice.
Well, I'll let you attend to your cat. I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Yep. Cass
Thanks
Eris.
For having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with rising YouTube star and cognitive psychologist Cass Eris. Also, I hope that you'll consider checking out her work on YouTube, which extends far beyond her deep dive into Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. She's doing some really great work. Let me know what you thought of this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. For my Patreon supporters, I'm going to be releasing two episodes of Parallax Views, the week that was current events program, in the coming days. One with my usual co-host Casey, and another with friend of the show Marlon Ettinger, who was recently in Britain canvassing for Jeremy Corbyn's failed election campaign. He'll be on to talk about that experience, as well as his recent suspension from Twitter for a little prank he did involving Michael Bloomberg. So if you're a Patreon supporter of Parallax Views, you have that to look forward to. I would highly recommend supporting me on Patreon if you do not already. It helps me to release the content for the main show. That support is very much appreciated. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.